coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello, everybody. Welcome. Welcome back. I hope everybody had a great week off. I hope you didn't take the week off from thinking. If you did, get ready for it tonight, because we've got a couple of really deep thinking guests. Our first guest coming up the top of the show tonight, which, by the way, is our first official show of our incarnation as Curious Realm. Last week was our 1 year anniversary show, and during that show, number one, sorry for the Facebook fail. Facebook utterly destroyed our stream. Like, granted, it was about 3.5-4 hours in to the 8 hour long live stream that Facebook failed, but Facebook failed. YouTube caught it all. It's all there. If you go to the website, you can click each individual speaker in the episode notes and it'll take you right to their part of the video. But we had a great list of guests last week. I want to give another great thank you to our friends, our family, my wife, our friends and supporters in the Facebook group. You guys are the rock on which this show is built, and a big hearty hands to you guys. Sincerely, tilt of the hat. Without you guys, this show is nothing. It's just me speaking into the void, which with a bunch of really interesting individuals and topics. Without you guys sounding off in the background, talking during the week, listening live and commenting live, even though I don't get to all of it, that's what keeps things moving. So appreciate that, all of you regular listeners out there. Our first guest tonight is going to be Mike Turber. We're going to be talking about UFOs, USOs specifically, underwater submerged object or unidentified submerged objects. And these really came to light for the first time. I mean, they'd been talked about. You'll watch Ancient Aliens. You'll hear about the episodes, you know, about USOs. They'll talk about Columbus seeing lights in the ocean outside of Cuba, all sorts of things. Yes, they've been seen for thousands of years by different cultures and stuff. But specifically, when it came to the House committee hearing on UFOs, UAPs, there were numerous questions that came about. What about these supposed reports of underwater submerged objects? We'll talk more about that in our closed door meeting, is what they were told, like all three times that they asked about underwater submerged unidentified submerged objects. The response was, we will address that in our closed door meeting after this. Well, I'm about to pull up, for those of you that have been following us since our incarnation as Dudes and Beer, which was the beginning of this show, in episode 235, we had our good friend Mike Turber on. We frequently talk about the episode with the Naruto run. This was actually the episode about the Naruto run. And during this was the first time that Mike ever dropped the nugget. This was long before Lou Elizondo, anything like that, folks. This was a long time ago. I'm trying to see if it shows me a published date on my website or if that's hidden. I think it might be hidden because I didn't like the way it looked in the template. But I can still hop over here and click this and find out what the actual published date was of that audio. And yeah, it is well before the time of Lou. So let's check this out. This is 2:35 from Dudes and Beer. This is about an hour and 20 minutes in. Mike and I are talking about a couple things, but check this out.
With a mind control ring? that the soldier wears and controls up to three drones, like that.
Rotating like plates inside. I don't know services. Area 51/ let's play with this little island off the coast of California and let's make that the launching point, or make it appear that that's the launching point, just so we can have radar blips that can be semi-explained, moving it. But they're moving in somewhere around 100 miles an hour or something. Something reasonable that would make it to their helicopter. But then, you know, then obviously the weird stuff started happening. And that's where some guy sitting on in a chair flying these things autonomously is having a blast. And we're,
now pay attention to this next minute.
These guys were getting telemetry back in real time. Now, back in the first incident off of Jacksonville, those during these incidences, the telemetry that was being fed back was being fed back real time, and people were monitoring this from several different areas. With the two existing manufacturers, obviously these objects are competing objects. They're the ones made by one company, one's made by another, and they're competing objects just like they do any project. They put them out there and say, okay. So what happened was this technology that's put into both of these objects is what is actually the cool part. And the cool part about this is that both craft have to be similar size. They both have to have these similar objects in them. They have to have two counter-rotating like plates inside. I don't know how this works because that wasn't what my job was. But these counter-rotating discs apparently have something to do with the technology that allows them to have anti-gravity. So the ability to maneuver these craft at these ridiculous speeds is one thing. The other end of the spectrum is, okay, what do we do to the outside of the craft to allow it to not have to deal with the temperature changes? So what you have is you have two competing internal technologies that handle propulsion, and you have one and only one external technology that was utilized to allow these craft to move through the air, which is 25 times less dense than water, and water, which is amazing that these craft are moving. I don't know how fast you know these craft were moving underwater, but these craft can move underwater at a very high clip with very little problem. They were tracked going underwater at well over 500 miles an hour.
Yeah.
Well over. They're tracked above.
And there you have it, folks. The main reason I play that clip, and I know it was about a minute or so long there, welcome back to the show, Mike Turber. That is our first official. I'm sure that there have been a couple things that we've mentioned on air previously as Curious Realm that have come to fruition. Mm-hmm. However, that's our first one for Curious Realm, because as of this last week, it came out publicly, nuclear submarine buzzed underwater, buzzed by underwater object traveling faster than the speed of sound.
Yeah.
And this was an event that, just like you described, happened in the late 1990s, everything else. So there we are once again faced with Mike Turber dropped it here. And it's one of those situations, Mike, that whenever you contact me and you're like, hey, I got something exclusive that I'd like to drop with you, or, you know, I've got something mm-hmm. that I'd just like to drop in casual conversation and it'll make sense in a year or so.
Yeah, that's true.
I never deny it ever.
You've been a trooper.
Intelligentsia is a long play game. It's literally like the people that go into a high rollers room at a casino and leave after 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Like, sorry, you're not in it to win it. High rollers are in there for like 18 hours straight, man. like,
very true,
you may
very
walk,
true.
You may walk off with a little bit, but you probably won't be walking off with a whole lot of their money. And that's kind of the same thing with intelligence. If you aren't willing to hang around and outwait the fish, you may not catch anything.
Very true. Very true. I call it kind of like planting a seed. I'll put out a little tidbit at some point in time. And because technically you can't come on and start talking about things that are classified. Obviously you would be crucified if you talk about classified things.
So, one would think so, but you could very well, you could very well, you know, keep your security creds. You could very well pick up a brand new contract from the government investigating metamaterials. You could do mm-hmm. all kinds of things if you release classified documentation that's not declassified.
Yeah, that's true. And if someone mentions something to you kind of in passing, or you stumble across something, it's a kind of a little different. It's kind of a weird scenario. Whereas recently, there's a flood of people that seem to be leaking this or that, and they're not going to jail. They're not going to Leavenworth. You know, what's going on with it? You know, you can point to Lou Elizondo himself if you like, and all the stuff he's done. Everybody's amazed. Okay, if you think about it, he's releasing information that should either be classified or at least not revealed yet or so forth, and nothing's happening. He still apparently has his clearance and what have you. I don't have mine now. I lost mine in 2009, but it's all good. But the good thing is there's a need to know situation. So mm-hmm. whenever you're put into a situation to where you need to know something, you're basically read into it, and you're part of it, and that's just it. And I still maintain any of those scenarios where you have to keep, you know, whatever classified information, or if it's not even classified, if it's just a situation where you just automatically know the information you're talking about should be, then you just don't say anything about it. Yeah. But these things come across the table periodically, where you'll run across something that you'll see a tidbit in the news, And then you'll remember, I remember something about that. And in this particular case, back when God, I don't remember when it was, I think it was 2015 is when the Tic Tac, scenario off San Diego kind of resurfaced a little bit. It had surfaced in 2007, I think, with a leak of the video on one of the websites and, or YouTube channels or Reddit or mm-hmm. somewhere. And then in 2015, it did again. And then, of course, the 2017 when it came out with CTSA. So you had that. And then in 2015, I had run across some reports where they write these reports into these logs and then they erase them. They literally just, they write it in and then they erase it. So you have, a log file that has something was entered and then it was erased. And I could have sworn it was written as 2008. So I originally had said that it was 2008, but it was actually, I believe, 1998. So it even goes back another decade that this report happened. Los Angeles class submarine based out of San Diego, out of Point Loma. There's some report, and then I was dumbfounded to find out that a scientist by the name of Bob McGuire apparently came out and basically confirmed it with Chris Lato on the Lato files. And I haven't even seen that episode yet. I still need to see it. I just read about it. I think it was, the Daily Star or whatever that mentioned it, and kind of floored me a little bit. I said, wow, that has to be the event, or maybe it's two events. It could actually be two separate events a decade apart. But it was interesting to see that, and you feel a little vindication, you know, when you bring something out and you say something, people go, oh, no one's 550 plus miles an hour underwater. Come on.
Yeah.
But you have to wonder when he said, in his interview, I believe he said that the object was traveling faster than that someone, not, it wasn't him that said it, but someone came out after they heard this object whiz by the submarine. And when you're underwater, you can hear a lot more than people think, especially in a submarine. If you're running quiet in a submarine, you can hear everything outside.
It's much more, the water is much more dense than air.
Yep.
And
yep.
carries water sound way better than air.
Exactly. It's 25
Not
times
with as much
more dense
definition,
than air.
But for a much longer distance and a much greater amplitude.
Well, the interesting thing is that if you're underwater, if anyone's been underwater and they've listened to like a boat going by, you can't tell which direction it's coming from because your ears are programmed essentially, or your brain is programmed to basically figure out where sound's coming from based on the speed of sound in air.
Yeah.
But when you're underwater, it's traveling much faster. It's going, you know, 3,300 miles an hour underwater. whereas on air, on land, it's going about, say, 760 at sea level. So it's a huge difference. And so you're just not programmed to tell it. But when you're underwater and something passes by you, you know, going super fast, whatever sound it was making, I would love to know what the sound sounded like. Is that, I don't think he described what it sounded like. He just knew something passed your submarine going super fast.
I've got it up from New York Magazine right now. Headline, December 22nd, 2016. Note, a year, almost a year and a week to the date before Lou Elizondo and the Tic Tac Go Fast Gimbal videos on CNN. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
The headline reads, supersonic underwater travel may be coming soon. That is a year and a week to the date before Lou Elizondo.
Is that using the tubes, or is that the one I did, or the...
The interaction between the fluid and an object's surface causes a phenomenon called skin friction drag. The faster you go, the more power you have to expend at an exponentially increasing rate. That's right. Just physics. But while Moore's law can make microchips twice as powerful every 18 months, cargo ships still cross the ocean at the same speed they did 150 years ago. But it is talking about, and this article is by Jeff Weiss, Jeff Wise, rather. And they're talking about the Russian super cavitating torpedo, which travels at almost supersonic speeds.
Yep. You know, that'll travel about 200.
230 miles an hour.
There you go. Yep. That's exactly correct. So you have that. You also have a Russian submarine that has a super cavitation, is what that actually is called. What it does is it creates like a series of bubbles around the actual craft. And underwater, the friction, you're displacing, when an object moves through air, it's displacing air in front of it, but that air is somewhat compressible, plus it goes over you, and it's a little bit easier to work with, and it's not as dense. Mm. Underwater, you multiply that times 25, and that's the density of the water versus air, and then water is incompressible. It's one of the few things that you simply can't compress it. You can add air to it and then compress the air to make it come out of a sprayer or whatever, but you can't compress the water. So as you're moving through the water, you're not only you're limited, your speed limitation is because of the displacement of the water in front of you. And I said this on another show when I was trying to figure out why it is the object, if it can move at whatever speed above the water, why does it slow down underwater? And we naturally can think that in our mind, but this object supposedly can do the same thing underwater. The reason I think that it has to slow down is because it's displacing the water in front of it, and that water has to go somewhere.
Mm.
And it's not that it's slowing the object down. It's that I think the displacement of the water creates a different situation for the craft as it's moving through it.
Yeah, but if you remember, though, and I've got up an article right now from because inside that article that I had was a footnote to the Underwater Express by DARPA. And that article came out in Pop Sci in 2009. This is from 2009, talking about DARPA readies an ultra-fast mini-sub, and this is a mini-sub that can go up to 100 knots.
And is that using supercavitation, or what was it using?
No.
Okay.
100 knots. The fastest submarine can only travel 20 to 35 knots while submerged, but if everything goes according to plan, the Underwater Express will speed along at 100 knots, allowing the delivery of men and material faster than ever. DARPA program originally first announced in 2006. Finally reached testing phase.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm going to guess that the skin of that object had to vibrate or resonate at some frequency to allow it to do that, which would be a form of cavitation.
Sub utilizes the phenomenon known as supercavitation.
There you go.
Yay. Go, Mike Turber. There you go. Tell him what he wins, John.
What do we have for him, Johnny? Well, we have the...
We got nothing.
That's awesome.
Dang it. But yeah, quite literally, like, even whenever you're talking about, you're talking about trying to get the water out of the way, but you have to remember with technology like Alcubierre, everything else, you're literally talking about creating a cavity that the object is being drawn into.
Right, right.
Goes beyond supercavitation.
Yeah, that's a whole another principle in and of itself. And then Jack, if you're listening, you can come on and explain this.
We need to get Jack on to talk about this because I think it really is a true example of a real world scenario use of that technology.
Yeah. Yep, Jackson. We're talking about Jack Sarfati.
Yes,
for the listeners out there, Jack, he's in London right now, so he's many hours ahead of us. Yeah. I don't know. I did send him a note saying that
he's ahead of us in a lot of ways.
Yeah, he's great on the show. He's fun to listen to. Hilarious at times, but he's awesome. He's put everything into this, and as far as trying to determine or trying to basically explain that what we're seeing is not defying the laws of physics. It's actually, you know, people use that term. I've used it before. You've used it. We've all used it. We've all said, well, defying the law of physics. It's actually not. It's actually working within, you know, general relativity and other laws of, you know, well, general relativity isn't a law, but it's working within the bounds of what physics is. And
yeah,
it's utilizing principles that, like the Alcubierre warp drive, which effectively is a warp bubble around, just like you have a supercavitation bubble, you have a warp bubble that's placed around the ship that sits, you know, is inside that bubble, and the ship's not actually moving at all. Space around it is being moved.
Well, the example that we've given before is that you can transport like a grain of rice in a straw inside of a bubble. The same way, by sealing it on each end, and if you squeeze that straw on one end, the bubble's going to move, and the grain of rice will go right with it.
Exactly, and that makes for faster than light travel possible. It makes several different things come into play that we otherwise wouldn't think about. To be able to traverse wormholes, to be able to deflect objects using the photon energy that's going to surround the craft anyway, that actually turns into like a nice little deflector. So you have all of these things that just because of that technology just becomes part of it. In the case of the supercavitation, as the problem with supercavitation is the object can't turn as quickly as you would probably want it to, but it would go super fast. Obviously, a torpedo traveling at 200 knots is something that no ship could outrun. You know, you can imagine hearing that. But then if this ship actually had an object pass by it at either, depending on which speed of sound he was talking about, at 760 miles an hour or at 3,300 miles an hour, either one is faster than anything ever recorded before. What was it? Who knows? Was it something the U.S. was testing back then? Did we have our own supercavitation torpedoes? Because each of these events, every single event happened during workups. It's when the Navy was getting ready to go on a cruise. It involved a carrier group, and it involved objects that are around nuclear-powered craft, whether it's a submarine. Just so you know, every single submarine the United States has is nuclear powered. All of them.
They retired the Seawolf fleet years and years ago, folks, and that was the last generation. I just know that from going to Seawolf Park down the road in Galveston as a kid, that was the last generation of diesel powered subs that we had. Battleship Texas was one of the last serving ones. Beyond that, they've all been nuclear.
And so with that in mind, apparently either something A is attracting these objects to objects that are nuclear powered, nuclear tipped, whether it be like a warhead or like a nuclear power generating station. And, you know, these objects are seen around them. And now obviously it's being revealed. It's been revealed before, but now it's becoming more poignant that the objects are being seen around nuclear powered submarines. And keep in mind, Commander Fravor, when he saw the object that he saw, the Tic Tac object, doing the ping pong thing around the surface of the water. There was a disturbance under the water that he thought was about the size of a 737, which happens to be about the size of a couple of the submarines that we have. And that disturbance could be a submarine diving, which I have my theory about what actually occurred that day. And that'll be a discussion for another show. But so if you have these objects capable of moving that fast underwater, it being revealed by this scientist, Bob McGuire, on Chris Leto's show that he witnessed this himself. I mean, this is the confirmation of it, that it actually has occurred. This is the first person that was on board a submarine that has come out and said, yes, this happened. I was on the USS Hampton in, you know, the late 90s, and we were at depth. They weren't like at the surface. They were at depth. And this object whizzed by, and everybody on the ship, you know, heard it. I mean, and, you know, that's when he said that some guy came out and he won't, you know, said he wasn't going to throw the guy under the bus, but a guy came out and said that, that thing just whizzed by us faster than the speed of sound. Of course, they didn't clarify which speed of sound, but speed of sound either way is ridiculously fast underwater. That's a thing now. And, you know, it makes you ask several questions. If it's not ours, whose is it? If it's not theirs, then you really want to know.
That was exactly the question posed by Congress in that hearing was, if it wasn't ours underwater, whose was it? And that's why they were like, hey, we will address that in our closed door meeting.
And it apparently was addressed. The contact that I have with obviously out, not mentioning too much more about that, but the feedback I got from that without being specific, or honestly, it wasn't told to me specifically either. So I'm just paraphrasing kind of the mood of what was stated, because they didn't tell me specifically on this one thing, because it wasn't the subject of the conversation that we were having. Some things were revealed, during that meeting of black projects that we had been working on, and things were being tested. Now, whether or not those objects being tested were the objects that were seen, by the guys on the Nimitz, that were part of the Nimitz group, or people that were part of the Roosevelt group, I don't know. That's the thing. I have a very good, theory of, I'll call it a theory of what both events are now. And I'm piecing together a video that's going to explain what I believe happened on both events. And it's based on very factual, information that I have that will make it make sense. And hopefully I'll have that out within the month. It takes a long time to put these things together. Oh my gosh, dude, it's incredible.
Interesting, because you brought up a point a while ago, Mike, that I want to loop back to, because I think it is an important part to dwell on mentally for a second. And that is the idea that all of these sightings, at least all the military sightings that we have, everything that we have from Gimbal, Go Fast, everything else, all from exercise drills of nuclear fleet.
Right.
Any possibility that maybe those Navy patented nuclear reactors that fit inside F-16s might be up around?
I would like to say so. Because
that's the last time we had you on was when I added this document that I have up on screen right now for the Lockheed Martin mini reactor that we've talked about for years, man.
Yeah,
you and I. Did. The fact that this reactor was the size of the room that I'm sitting in the video that was made, and he was saying we can 2-3 generation this every year. By the time we're done with this project, I need another job, and I'm like 28.
Yeah, and I first ran across that back in 2014 or 15. Actually, it's 2014, 15 is actually when I started getting back into checking on some things. That's when I ran across that. So they were working on a cold fusion reactor that would essentially be miniaturized to fit inside of F-16 to give you a nuclear powered aircraft, mm-hmm. which they actually, you know, dabbled with that before. They had a working prototype of the apparatus that would later become that, not the actual, you know, propulsion part of it, but they the proof of concept part. So yeah. It is possible to do that. And then of course they needed much, much more power. Well, the only way you're going to get much more power, is to switch to fusion. And that is something that they said in 2014 that they would have in about 5 years. We're well past 2019. So maybe it's already here. Maybe some of the things that we may be seeing or some of the things going on are dealing with that. I think it might be a combination of technologies where you have the DRFM technology, you know.
I still love the idea that in this schematic that the lasers are called heat injectors. That's my favorite thing in the world, that the two lasers that would be used to fusillate the fuel and ignite the fuel to start the reaction are called heat injectors.
Exactly.
Like it's a moving part engine.
Yeah, it's almost like they're trying to hide the fact that they're lasers.
Your laser cylinders.
Yeah. So you have a high magnetic field that you have to hold it in, and then you've got your heat injector.
Yeah,
sounds like something you would put
encapsulating
in turkey or
something. Coils and you know, like all these other high end terms. The others, heat injector.
They switch to the simple one now.
Source? No. We don't want to let them know what it is.
That's right. It's gallium arsenide laser. No, it's not. Yeah, we had a KC-135, a converted KC-135. I think I could talk about this. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. That was flying around with a functional laser. God, back in the 80s or early 90s, it was. But it took the entire aircraft. The laser took up everything, you know, every inch of that aircraft to basically fire that thing. And nowadays, now your sixth generation craft, which they just revealed, the B-21 Raider, is the first official sixth generation aircraft, or it's a bomber actually, might utilize new technology. Which is funny because the previous bomber was made 30 years ago. So it's been 30 years since we've had a bomber produced. And here we are with the B-21, which looks a lot like its predecessor. And I'm wondering if it uses the same thing on the forward part of the wings. You know, another thing Jack could probably explain is this electromagnetic, apparatus that's on the front, section of the wing to make it go through air faster and also have a lower radar signature and what have you. So it's kind of an interesting technology to try to figure out. Part of Salvatore Paez, whatever it's pronounced, part of his secret sauce plan. Now, he was interviewed recently, and when I did see that interview, a lot of my opinion on some of his patents changed a little bit. Because when his patents first came out, remember those patents that showed? I mean, he should have 5 Nobel prizes. I mean, 5 patents, 5 Nobel prizes, because each of the patents that he claims to have, or the Navy claims to have, I guess, but he's on the patents, are technologies that are game changers. Anti-gravity, a transmedium craft that can move through air and water. Obviously, the shape of it was either the diamond or the triangular shape, which we all well know is what might be the TR-3B or, you know, what have you. So basically a room temperature superconductor, you know, all these different patents that he came up with, and each individual one on its own would be the patent of the century, you know, but he's got three of the 5 would be, you know, truly game changers. And if they're real and they're legit, that would be great. But most of the physicists, virtually every physicist that has looked into those, reads them as gibberish, which may be on purpose to fool other nations into wasting money trying to make the same thing. But we'll still actually have their actual craft because back when one of the patents came out, the phone call was made to the patent office by the CTO of the Navy, basically saying that when the patent was denied, he called them and said, well, you're denying a patent, but we have the question is, do you have a functional prototype? And apparently he answered that, yes, we did. Either that or that we're very close to it, but they had something functioning in the laboratory to prove the concept would work. That's a game changer right there. So, but we haven't seen it yet. And it, you know, it falls into the Navy patent process. But yeah, at the same time, these patents were not done in the way they normally are done, is in kind of in a dark room. They're done the black patents, which the public never sees, but these were put in the public domain and everybody can see them, including other nations or what have you. But
yeah,
who knows? You know, who knows? Well, one day we'll know for sure. And we can congratulate Sal and he'll get the Nobel Peace Prize, the Nobel Prize, or maybe not. He won't get the Peace Prize. That won't happen.
Yeah, but, I mean, I've got the patent for the TR-3B up right now, you know, and it's one of those, like, these things are out there. And yep. yes, you do have to ask the educated question. How much of them are trash?
Right.
You know, not that the government could not easily go in and be like, hey, patent office, we need a patent number.
Mm-hmm.
What for? Just give us a patent number. Or that they even have like a random lot assortment assigned to them, you know, for such things, for disinformation, to put them out there and, yeah, make foreign governments, foreign entities, foreign contractors even, yeah, or even domestic contractors bidding on foreign contracts, believe that this technology is out there and that it needs to be beat. And
yeah, and that's a real thing.
Yeah,
that's,
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah,
that's a real thing to do.
The whole idea behind the concept of the Great Escape and why it was like an officer's duty to try to escape was literally just to confound the enemy and to make them spend vast amounts of money.
Yep.
And time and
resources.
And we
did the same thing with Russia when we knew that they were stealing the plans for the space shuttle.
Yeah.
We put up some goofy plans for them to copy, and they copied part of it, but their propulsion system for their space shuttle, the Buran, was definitely different. I mean, I actually admire their system. It really was a cool looking system, but it only flew once, but it did fly. You know, there's reasons for doing that, and it's a massive way to basically destroy your enemy by putting out that disinformation so that they copy it. They copy the wrong things, and they waste millions or billions of dollars doing this stuff. But we apparently have the money and the wherewithal to continue, and that's why we won the Cold War and so forth. So, and here we are to this day. But circling back to where we're supposed to be.
That's an important thing to consider and an important thing to talk about, though, because when you're talking about intelligentsia, when you're talking about these types of programs, when you're talking about alphabet agencies, the money that goes into them, the whole reason that it rang up a congressional hearing to begin with.
Right.
Was that somebody was sitting at home and had a spit take. When they saw the footage and went, "What? I'm on that committee. Yeah. How come we didn't hear about that?"
Yeah, yeah. And when you literally go and you look, when they put that video up there, I couldn't believe that of all the videos they had for the UAP task force to put up that video, that was the one. They and it's gone by, you know. And then I guess recently another. Apparently another pilot has taken a picture of a triangular shaped object or whatever using his iPhone. Mm. And you kind of start to wonder, okay, why are these pilots having to use iPhones to take pictures? Apparently, well, maybe they don't have an AirPod on their plane at the time they're going out, or that it's just convenient.
It's also just disturbing as hell, man. Don't text and drive. What the hell's wrong with you? Yeah. You're driving like a multi-million-dollar piece of machinery at Mach 0.8. Put the phone down.
And then, of course, the mind is boggled by the fact they're pulling out their cell phones to take pictures of you, saying, don't you have cameras on your plane, man?
Come on. But once again, like, I'm showing the video right now that is, of course, that we're talking about, the one that came out on CNN. But that's a forward-looking infrared pod. And as we said before, once again, other technologies that are out there, the laser chaff system that now exists, that would have definitely been being researched at the time that video was taken.
Absolutely.
Which is a forward-facing laser pod, folks, that sits on the front of, guess what, the F-18 platform, the same thing that all of these images come from, same thing that is 90% of our carrier fleet is F-18. So, and then
they're releasing Navy. It's mostly the Navy that the Air Force is getting their own. Just so you know, I mean, in the background, we have to discuss this. People are wondering, why isn't the Air Force? It should be the Air Force that is coming forward with all these images and pilots seeing things or whatever. Well, it is happening. It's just the Air Force has a completely different way of managing how they do these reports, and they don't necessarily come out to the public, where the Navy is more streamlined somehow, and their policy is to allow some of this information to come out, I guess, without delving into the reasons why. The Air Force has its own fair share of these situations, and I guess maybe one day down the road someone's going to come out and start leaking those reports as well, but there's some other it's a topic for another show, but there's a lot of internal conflict between the organizations or the branches of how they report these systems
As I was mentioning, and as we've mentioned before, I was just showing the laser pod specifications, everything else. And it's funny how every single video that we have of these things, other than the cell phone videos, which seems like are coming out more and more now, I think maybe because people have started to realize, wait a minute, there's one known quantitative amongst all this. It's being taken by the same kind of camera system from the same kind of weapons platform.
Yeah, it's either going to be a at FLIR or FLIR, or it's going to be someone's cell phone.
And it's coming for it's one of those you cannot identify the object because you can't actually see the object. It's in FLIR form, so it's going to be brighter than usual. You won't see a lot of definition at that speed. But every single characteristic described by these pilots of what they saw on the cameras and on their, and hey, no offense, if it's on your camera and that's what you're looking at, cool. But the shape that's on there floating around at this speed certainly does seem a whole lot. Let me bring up the document right there next to it. Seems a lot like the same shape that is the infrared target signature. And that's just me. I'm going to go to a known quantitative scenario before I leap to extraterrestrial or before I even leap to enemy craft.
And years ago, it was just about the opposite. You and I had a lot of conversations to where you leaned the other way a little bit. And I think the more research that you've done and that I've done as well, and the more I look into it, the more I start finding prosaic, answers for some of these situations. Just like when Ryan Graves, when he mentioned that on the Roosevelt, situation, the Roosevelt event, we'll call it that, with the gimbal and go fast, when he mentioned that the only object that any of the pilots ever saw with their own eyes, and he said it happened between, say, 8 and 12 times out of the 2.5 years that they saw these objects every day, they only saw them with their own eyes 8 to 12 times. And in those times, every single one of them was the cube and the sphere. And as soon as he said that, I was like, cube and the sphere, that is a radar reflector inside of a buoyancy layer pressurized balloon that is utilized for many reasons. One of those reasons is DRFM, which is digital radio frequency modulation, which allows you to spoof aircraft. It's part of Nemesis. So,
sure. And I mean, I've got up the article right now from just a year ago, October 2021, South China Sea, U.S. submarine collides with unknown object. Hit with Alexander Neil, a Singapore defense security expert, told the BBC the number of injuries caused by the collision suggested that the submarine probably, quote, hit something big and was, quote, going really fast.
Yep.
The incident was not unheard of, he said, but not common either. So,
right, that's true. And Russia has their submarine, the Z2, I think it's the Z222, which is an easy number to remember. Is their sub that is fitted with the ability for supercavitation, so it can travel about 50 some odd knots. That's moving. I mean, that's really all I ask for a submarine. Whereas submarines are limited to about 25 knots, you know, maybe faster. Hmm. So, you know, it's the determination of what equates to actual factual information. You know, what is fast? You know, just like we're talking about earlier, you mean speed of sound underwater or speed of sound above? You know, which one are we talking about?
But pretty fast, 3, but markedly different.
Exactly. So some of this, the stuff is frustrating. As you investigate this stuff, you kind of want more specific information, and it's hard to get it because they just don't know. It's like Bob McGuire, he's inside of a submarine, something whizzed by going super fast, some guy runs out and says some information, that's all he has. It would be nice if the sonar operator came forward and could specify dates and where it is on the log file, and whether they dogged the file. Well, it's a term called dogging the file, which is when they come in and they erase everything, just so you know. It's called log it and dog it. I think Sean Cahill is one that mentioned that here recently, where he, stated that it's a common practice for them to log something in pencil and then erase it, just so that there is a log file entry that you can see somebody entered something, but they didn't want to leave some of these entries in there because of whatever reason. I won't speculate as to the reason. I have a lot of ideas, but why they would erase an encounter like that. Hopefully they don't do that now. Hopefully the stigma is gone, and that anytime they get something that's out of the ordinary, that information is logged and remains in the log so that it can be studied and looked at to see what it is. Unless it's ours, probably what some of this stuff is. But even if it's theirs, the real question is it from out there? Is it out there theirs? That's a new term. We'll use that one. That's exclusive to your show.
The out there theirs. Yeah. We got a few out there theirs.
OTTs, out there theirs.
but in all sincerity, we really do have to look at this information in a new light, because it's been floating around out there. It's been out there. It's been mentioned once again, like when we had the conversation, you and I, when the hearings happened, that I was very interested in the fact that that was one of the things that was said, because this had been mentioned in communities before.
That's right. You had called me before.
And it was very interesting to me that they were interested about it. And that was one of the only things that they gave zero clear answer on, that they weren't like, well, we don't really know. Mm-hmm. Their answer was clear and definitive. Their answer was, we will talk about that in our closed door meeting after this.
Right. I remember that. I remember our conversation that you had called me right when I got off the phone with that certain person. And I was floored, but I wanted to tell you so bad.
Yeah.
And I couldn't at that moment. I think we discussed some of
that. That to me was my moment of confirmation to begin with.
Yep, exactly.
Because they asked not once, not twice, but thrice about USOs, and every single time it was the same formulaic answer. You know, much like when you hear from somebody that's read onto something, like, I don't really have a comment about that.
Exactly. And then by them not commenting, they're commenting.
They're commenting, like, I really can't tell you anything about that. But yes, I know things.
And just told me that you do know something about it. So I appreciate that.
And it seems like you know something, too.
Yeah, a little bit.
Nice to know you, friend. Shut up.
Exactly.
Shut up.
Things get interesting. It's weird because when you're in the public sector and then you delve into, you know, that world and you cross lines and you've got buddies on the other side that are itching to tell you something or itching to ask your opinion on something. And I get both. It's because people, for some reason or another, they value my opinion on certain things. Why? I don't know.
I'm the same way. And you're one of them. That's like, I wish I could tell you this. Sometimes it's hurtful to me because you call me and you're excited and you're like, man, I wish I could tell you about this thing. It's like, oh, you punk. Yep. I want to know about it so bad now. Let me know about it.
I'll eventually tell you. It's like it just happened. It's so frustrating. And sometimes it's just I don't have all the information yet or enough information to know if it's true. Keep in mind, back when I originally did the if you want to call it the hoax or whatever, the original Tic Tac story, it wasn't a hoax. A lot of what I was saying was actually factual information. It's just that I didn't have the other pieces of it yet. And as I started getting into this more, I was like, wow, I'm actually putting some of these pieces of the puzzle together and starting to make more sense now. Mm. But there was a documentary that was being worked on and, anyway, that's water under the bridge. But now a lot of everything is making a lot more sense. And it's making obviously terrestrial sense, not extraterrestrial sense, but as you piece these things together, you start to wonder, it's like, wow, okay, so this technology is in existence. In 2014, Lockheed Martin put out that video about them having the fusion technology that they could put on a plane the size of an F-16, in X number of years. Is that plane flying? How did they shield that thing? All of these different things. And how do you take a fusion reactor, put it on a plane and make it generate thrust? How's that happen? There's all kinds of, it's interesting to ponder that and to scale that thing down to that size. So all these technologies that are being worked on by several different civilian, essentially what amounts to civilian companies that are working under contract, it's out there.
You know what just popped into my head as soon as you said, how do you put that onto an engine and make it make thrust? You use that to supercharge a hydrolyzer and you power it with hydrogen.
That'll work. That'll work.
And then with something like that, you could hydrolyze and heat induct rapidly on a mass scale and get a crazy amount of BTUs and thrust of pure hydrogen fuel to begin with.
And there's plenty of that. We'll never run out of that. That's what the sun uses. And maybe we can make some helium because of the problem is we don't have enough helium on our planet because when you go to buy balloons now, they're using more nitrogen inside the helium. You can't make that sound with your voices as well. And that makes me mad.
And one of the articles that I posted this last week, it was literally out of MIT, talking about MIT engineers design surfaces that make water boil more efficiently. And I mean, the original stuff came out in MIT News back in July. The articles just hit the shelves. But it's like when you're talking about these kind of technologies out there, like it's a cat's cradle. Is what you have to think of, folks. You really do have to think about this stuff in a fractal way and in kind of a cobwebby kind of way, because they want it cobwebs. They want it back in the corner. They want it tied to strings, tied to strings, tied to strings.
Yeah. And then that way only a certain sector can benefit from that for the time being. You know, it's just like when the guy on the Lockheed Martin video, when he states that cold fusion will be, you know, inside of 5 years, we'll have working, functioning cold fusion.
Yeah. And, sure, we'll put it in weapons first, but, you know, and exactly. For defense uses. But when it comes to the world, you know, imagine the power.
Yeah.
imagine the power.
Exactly. And so, and people are questioning, it's like, well, that would solve all the world's energy problems right away. But no, we need to put it in weapons first, because that's what's going to fund it in the first place. That's where the money comes from. That's where the money goes. We have to put it there. Yeah. And then once we can intimidate the rest of the world with all these wonderful cold fusion flying F-16s that Chris Lato wants to come back and fly, he'll probably come out of retirement and come back and fly one of those. I'm sure he'd love to do it. And with that being the case, then they have to realize, wow, okay, yeah, it kind of makes sense. The defense has to have it first, blah, blah, blah. But still, it's going to solve the world's energy. You know, I mean, we're not in energy. I don't like using the word crisis ever, unless it's actually a crisis.
Yeah.
But there's so many different aspects of it that when you think about it, if they could simultaneously develop this technology where it could be used in limited form in certain areas. But you could park an aircraft carrier, so to speak, off the coast of a city and power the city. I mean, if you can have a Ford truck that's going to, the Lightning that's coming out next year, can power your home for 3 days. You know, just plug in your truck to your house, you can power your home. Imagine what a nuclear powered aircraft carrier could do. So something along those lines could go and power certain areas for a limited basis. We have just recently we had a person or someone shoot at a substation and was able to knock out the power for a large area. Imagine being able to just flip a switch and turn on one of these generators and just immediately replace that substation with this object that's inside of a truck that could power a whole city. I mean, that's the technology we're talking about. And that is very tangible, very real, and it's happening either as we speak or very soon.
It's definitely happening as we speak. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine that it's not the whole reason that you put patent out. And this patent, just so you know, folks, published 2018, filed 2013.
Mm-hmm.
So it took 5 years for it to make it through the patent process.
Right.
And when you apply for the patent, you have to have a working model. So that means at the point that the patent went in, they were at this scale size.
Mm-hmm. And that's a semi-tractor trailer size that I think when I went to Skunkworks, there's building 600, which is the big building where they do a lot of the assembly. But I think it's building 601 or 603, whatever it was. That was the building that had, that they were working on the energy part, the high energy part, because you could tell from the outside, you could see all of this power going into it. And I knew if a lot of power is going into it, that's either one, they're working on some system that requires a lot of power, or B, they're working on something that generates a lot of power.
Yeah.
Or both. And it becomes interesting. I did not go inside that building. I'm not going to make any claim that I did. So I didn't see anything or anything like that. But you could tell that there was something going on. It wasn't the building that had all of the simulators, which has a similar appearance, but it's another one. But you have to wonder, Lockheed Martin, if they're able to do this back in 2012, 2013-ish, and then obviously the 5 years, 2018, to get the patent stuff to go through.
Yeah.
And then other companies. There's another company the Navy had contacted with. I think the Navy gave them $25 million. And if I remember correctly, it was the company's called EM2 squared or EMC.
I believe you are correct.
And EMC2. So that company... Yeah, EMC2, yep. And that company effectively was put out of business almost because the Navy switched that contract out from them. But they had, it was this major competition of getting to that cold fusion, that cold fusion temperature, or just getting fusion in general, where you generate more power than you take in.
Yeah.
So you see these companies come up and then you see them kind of dwindle away, which is kind of sad because a lot of technology is moving forward on different fronts and you just don't know which one to put the money on. It's like going and which number do you bet on at the roulette wheel, you know, but think of all these companies. 36 different names of these companies inside there. Which one do you put your money in? So you put a little bit of money in all of them and see which ones make the progress. That's why the DARPA programs are so important. And moving forward, you're going to see.
It's interesting the way that they operate because they actively go out and it's literally have blue things like that where it's like, okay, folks, these are the parameters. They won't tell you what you're working on necessarily. But these are the parameters of the technology that we need. Now, here's the three of you, and here's a budget for each of you. Go accomplish it and show us how you did it.
Exactly. It's like a contest. You know, and DARPA has a system internally, which is they have the open catalog, which you can actually go into as a civilian and actually look at it. You can join DARPA as a civilian and go in and become a part of their project. It is not hard to do. And once you do it and you get to a certain level, you can sponsor other people to come in, hint, 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 if you want to be sponsored. And if they have an open catalog, you can imagine they probably have something called closed catalog, which is another kind of section to where once you're in, then they start bringing out some other projects or whatever that you can get involved in. But then they have the DARPA hards. And the DARPA hards are the ones where they're dealing with technology that borderlines the unreal, the unbelievable. And that's where some of this fringe technology exists, and where it's coming from. And, there's a lot of money put into those programs. I mean, you get $53 billion, you know, put into a certain area of the intelligence community. You can imagine what they're probably building, and which obviously would involve the National Reconnaissance Office and maybe some new satellites and platforms on being able to do ISR work. But we're living in a very interesting time right now, and we're going to see the advancement of technologies over the next decade that have never been seen before. That, you know, we always heard that cold fusion is 10, 20 years away.
Impossibility. Is what I've been told my entire life, Mike.
Yep.
Impossibility. The thing of movies like Chain Reaction, the stuff of fantasy, the stuff in the realm of science fiction, we will never see a zero point energy. And granted, I don't believe we will ever see a zero point energy. And what we are talking about here is not by far a zero point energy. You're still talking about a granule of fuel being accelerated via heat induction. Heat inducers.
Heat injectors.
With my air quotes, the heat injectors.
Heat injectors. I think that's like an adapter. I hooked into my microwave to cook the turkey.
You know, though, if you're talking to an airplane mechanic and trying to teach him a little bit about a nuclear reactor, not a bad idea to call it an injector, dude.
Probably, yeah.
You know, like it's a laser, but it's injecting the fuel.
And people wonder how do they get like the center of these accelerators and stuff up to a certain temperature, you know, to do this. And obviously, you know, the laser, the magnetic field holds it there and creates the plasma, and then the laser fires into it to get to the temperatures hotter than the center of the sun. So,
absolutely. I've actually got the breakdown up on screen right now. Figure 2, which is the one of the heat injectors, everything else, the one after that that showed the flow map, illustrates an example of an aircraft system that utilizes one or more fusion reactors according to certain embodiments. Aircraft system includes one or more fusion reactors, a fuel processor, one or more auxiliary power units, and one or more turbofans. Mm-hmm. Fusion reactors supply hot coolant to turbofans, e.g. either directly or via fuel processor, using one or more heat transfer lines. In some embodiments, hot coolant, this is a FLIBE, i.e. a mixture of lithium fluoride and beryllium fluoride, or lithium lead, LIPB. In some embodiments, hot coolant is additionally supplied to APUs. Once used by turbofans, return coolant is fed back to fusion reactors to be heated and used again. In some embodiments, return coolant is fed directly to the fusion reactors. In some embodiments, return coolant may be additionally supplied to fusion reactors from APUs. So you've got a few different ways to be able to flow that coolant around to fuel things, to hyper boost things, you know, by going, okay, we've got a reaction going, but we can feed that hot fuel, that hot spent stuff back into it,
mm-hmm.
and get more out of it. You know, some really interesting just concepts there, just reading through the quick paragraph of the actual concept of operation. And to go back up to that figure, let me hop back up to that, folks, because that really does kind of illustrate the way that everything moves around inside the engine.
Yeah, and just saying the APU is auxiliary power unit, and that's what gets it, you know, kicked off the go.
Yeah.
Just as a side note, the APU that they used to use for the SR-71 was actually a Buick Wildcat, the 401, you know, cubic inch version of the V8. That's how they started the SR-71, no joke.
Yeah. And they show this system having three fusion reactors going into a fuel processor, breaking out into two APUs, going out to two turbofans each, and then returning mm-hmm. back the same direction. That's their figure two, to basically show you from a front end, fuselage down and out. Pretty interesting. And
yep. Which isn't a whole lot different from the original, you know, nuclear bomber that they talked about years and years ago. Yeah. I mean, the premise is the same in the, you know, you're taking, you know, superheated air and placing it into a chamber, allowing it yeah. to expand to come out the back to produce thrust. It makes sense. Back then, of course, they didn't have the technology to create things that would withstand the temperatures or the pressures involved. But obviously now, you know, we do.
Well, even in that video, the scientist was talking about how it's not that these will come in and replace everything. It's that they mm-hmm. will come in and supplement the technologies that are in place in the electric right. grid. So same thing here, same thing in a diesel truck. It would be going in as a supplemental to what's there to make what's there last longer or perform in a different way.
There you go. Just like the truck I have. This is a 1997, you know, Ford F-250 with yeah. two turbochargers on it. And now a new superheated turbocharger could be pretty cool.
Now,
the nuclear one.
Kind of nutshelling this before we wrap here, Mike.
Sure.
Because I think the concept of USOs, once again, not detracting from them in any way, shape, or form.
Right.
Not trying to say that there's a lot of people who would tell you, no, Columbus did not see a USO. Doesn't say that anywhere. Cool, whatever. Doesn't really make a hide nor hair difference to me about the conversation that we are talking about now about modern right. day USOs and the technology at hand, the technology right. that we know exists. And if it's being leveraged above the ground and in the air, it's definitely being leveraged in the known quantitative of our waters.
Absolutely.
Military.
And I just hope that it's all ours, that we're the only ones that have it. We seem to be the only ones that have a patent on it.
What happens once the patent comes out? And that's something that you have to consider is that, hey, this isn't a patent coming out from you'd expect to see it from something like GE. They mm-hmm. bring good bombs to life.
Yeah, that's true.
And they were at the forefront of you know, peacetime turned warfare to begin with, not the opposite way around. Warfare turned peacetime, which is what Lockheed mm-hmm. Martin is, full on, like, no offense. Like they said, right. We will be using this for defense first. We are a defense first industry.
Yep.
You know, and the day we can make it adapt to your home automobile, believe me, you'll be able to get a reactor option. You
right.
know?
Well, it's just like spinoff technologies that spun off from NASA. People wonder, you know, why did we spend so much money to go to the moon, and what did we get out of it? Well, we got a lot
Velcro.
Out of it.
Damn it.
Yeah.
Velcro, and if you think that's not good enough foam. For you, I think mm-hmm. you need to reevaluate Velcro. Quite honestly.
Yeah.
I don't think you use near enough Velcro in your life.
No, and you definitely need to get some free sample packs of that and try it out and see how useful it is.
Yeah.
You know, and then like this new stuff that's actually called alien tape. I'm not proponent. I don't make money on alien tape, but I can tell you this. That stuff works, and the principle behind it is so simple. It's just making tape a more of a gel so it adheres to more surface area.
Yes, yeah, so it holds, can get into the grooves.
I have speakers on my wall held with alien tape. No screws, nothing. Just
not
alien
an ad
tape.
For alien tape. I get no money from them. I have not tried the product.
Oh my gosh, you need to try it. It's actually
but yeah, these technologies end up being leveraged in so many ways, man. So many ways. Like when we first heard about stuff like the F-117, the B-1 bomber, those kind mm-hmm. of things, Mike, that's when we first started hearing the words carbon fiber.
Yeah.
You know, and now you can buy a carbon fiber wallet. You can, we can print with carbon fiber at home.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. You can actually do that now. And what's amazing about carbon, I was making knives out of, you know, but we made actual blades out of it too, but the handles and stuff like that were carbon fiber. And then I got to meet Mr. Rattan, and then watching what he was making, it is absolutely amazing. So, and it was, God, what was the name of the company? Out in the Mojave is where they were, you know, a lot of the carbon fiber technology came from. But it's basically, you know, it's a polymer with graphite fiber, and you just have the incredible strength of it. And now there you have the graphite nanotubes.
Exactly. One begets the other, begets the next. And it's the fact of once the barrier is broken, the next step is not that far behind and is not that insurmountable a task anymore. You know, we are now to the point of customizable nanotubes. Like they're talking about printing like space elevator lifts out of carbon nanotubes, stuff like that.
That would be about the only thing that could support it. And that's something that I would love to see in my lifetime is the space elevator. Because I mean, you and I, we grew up probably, you know, exactly. And you see this, and you're like, wow, that's a hell of a concept. But it boggles the mind that an object in space would be an elevator to that, because your mind thinks, well, it has to be traveling. Well, the object in space would be traveling, say, 17,500 miles an hour or whatever at geosynchronous orbit to get it over one spot of land. But God, could you imagine how cheap it would be to get stuff to space that way? That was always the promise.
Yeah.
But, you know, who knows?
Yeah. Even if just to have a rail going out to space that just flings it out there. And they've come out with some great centripetal systems, things like that, that have been like conch shell launch systems that have been really, really great.
I don't think that system, I watched the documentary on it, and I just,
putting a person in that.
Oh, hell no. It's almost like putting a person in Elon Musk, you know, Starliner. You think you're, you know, you look at this and you go, wow, watch that thing land. And then when you see it land the first time, you know, not the times it exploded, you're like, oh, hell no.
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah. No, I'm good.
At the very last second, we're going to go from a horizontal position and flip up and kick it forward with two engines and then land on one engine and nail. We have to nail the landing because there's no going around. It's like the space shuttle. You have one chance at getting this done right. And when you see that flip at the end,
it's why you don't ride rides at the carnival to go higher than 10 feet.
No,
they are not permanent installations, nor are they meant to operate as such.
No, and you hear the horror stories of the things going up, man. Yeah, that's true. That's true. But we're going to see it. We're going to see what happens with all this new technology. And I'm so happy to be here at this time. I mean, there's no time in history that we've seen this much change. I'm sure sometime in the future there'll be so much change, but we're not aware of that yet. But we do know that this is an amazing time to live in.
You can be somewhat aware of it, though, Mike, because when we talked about this the first time around, we talked about technologies that existed. We talked about things like supercavitating missiles and the submarine tech that led to, you know, red tide or not red tide, Hunt for Red October,
right.
Stuff like that. Absolutely based on real technology.
You know? Absolutely. Tom Clancy was given extraordinary ability to visit and gather that information for his book. That's amazing.
Well, I always want to thank you for coming on, for sharing your vast knowledge of this technology, for beating ideas around, and for really helping common sense break down the way a lot of these things connect in the background.
That's something I enjoy doing. I mean, this is just an area that I'm not going to be able to get away from. It's just, I'm too entrenched in it, and I absolutely enjoy it. And I think in the future, you know what I'd like to do on one of your shows is just do a full show of just, you know, people asking questions, you know, just,
I'd love to do that.
Let's plan for that one day and just say, okay, we're going to have the show next week. It's going to involve this technology, but you can ask about just about anything, and we'll try to piece it together in a digestible form. Like super explain it, and make it, easily to digest. Cause sometimes you'll watch a show and you're left more confused at the end of it. So, okay, what did he say? Mm. But, you know, bring technology.
I've got a phone number. We've got a Google Voice, everything else for our experiencer line. We can absolutely make that happen where it's like calling questions. This is the topic. Mm-hmm. This is the technology that we're talking about. If you have a question about it, call in, leave your message. Cause you know, being able to actively take calls in the middle of everything can be a little hard.
And then, of course, you get the guys that come in and call in to have a little fun with you, too. But sure.
You know, and then there's like AJ used to say, like, I don't know if we're doing call-ins. Every time we do call-ins, there's some guy that for some reason is at home drunk at noon. It's like, you know, dude, I used to be the guy at home drunk at noon because I got off work at 8 a.m.
Yeah, there you go.
I worked the midnight shift, man. I worked graveyards. That was my nighttime.
Yeah, you were exactly shifted by 12 hours, just like me.
Judge, I mean, America, if you see somebody walking out of the corner store at 6 a.m. with a couple of 16 ounces, don't be like, wow, that guy. Think about it. Like, he may be going home to be like me and literally have that with like pancakes and cracklings for breakfast. You know?
But if you're fishing and it's 10 o'clock in the morning, that's like the primo time to pop a beer. Cause there's nothing like popping a super ice cold beer other than being out on hot water.
There's a reason this show used to be called Dudes and Beer.
There you go.
And while there is still a beer crack hidden inside of our intro, I think that will always be their residence somehow. But Mike, I want to thank you again for coming on tonight, for really breaking this down. When I saw the article last week and posted it, I was like, man, you got to come on because like I knew, you contacted me today. It was episode 325 or 235 of Dudes and Beer. So, that goes back quite a few years ago.
It does. And I appreciate you having me. I always have a good time on your show. I always the subject matter and you're a host that has some knowledge yourself, and that's that's what's that makes this flow go back and forth. It's not just some guy coming on the show just spilling off a bunch of stuff and then the host asks a question here and there that he has written down and then not really understanding what the answers are. You're into this. So you're in this. You're one of the few hosts that are like this. You've got an award that proves that you deserve that award.
I didn't win it this year. But I won it last year for News and Politics, Concern It.
Yeah.
As dudes and beer, no less.
Oh, well, that's fine. Well, we know it's you. We know it's you. Yeah, you just have the Chris Jordan show.
That's right. Yeah, the Jordan Power Hour.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Hey, man, you take care of yourself. You be safe out there with all your investigating. I know you were getting ready to hit the road to do a bunch of stuff, so... be safe out there, man. Stay in touch. You know,
I appreciate it.
Ping me every now and then just so I know you're alive, bud.
Well, I'll be coming by there. You're in the city that I have some people I need to visit. You kind of have an idea too, but so I might be doing a little pit stop by and we could do a live show right there just like we did when I was coming out this way. So,
Sounds great.
We can do that. All right, buddy.
All right. You have a good one, man. We'll talk to you on the flip side, Mike.
You got it, buddy. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Mike Turber, everybody, with 5x5 News. Thank you so much, Mike, for always coming on. I love it whenever you do. You are always amazing to talk to. You've always got a great view on these things and really do have a grasp and a way of breaking it down. While you are online, folks, checking out everything from Mike Turber and 5x5 News on YouTube, which is where you should totally go. Just go to YouTube and look up 5x5 News. The handle is at 5x5 News US. So stop on by and check them out. While you're online checking them out, of course, make sure to stop on by. Check out the Knowledge Vault on Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com/knowledge is where you can go to find all your declassified government programs, materials, scientific studies, things like that. If you'd like to send us a question for a guest or like to send us your active experience, stop on by curiousrealm.com/story. That will take you to our experiencer page where you can actively give us your experience of the paranormal, cryptids, your experience with the strange, the anomalous. If you are a witness to UFOs, UAPs, you can put pictures, videos in there. If you have a question for a guest or a guest idea, stop on by and share it with us, folks. CuriousRealm.com/story is that page. Thank you so much once again for tuning in. We will be right back after these messages with our guest, Dr. Kathleen Ball. She is the creator of the Brazilian Templar Mystery. It's on Gaia Network. I've watched it. It's a great documentary. The research is astounding and really goes into the Templars going to Brazil, why they went to Brazil, why they chose Brazil out of all things, what they did to obscure their journey to Brazil, and what evidence she found of them arriving there. So we will be getting into that and so much more with Dr. Kathleen Ball right after this, folks. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that commercial break. Thank you so much to all of our sponsors, especially WebWorks Wireless. Those guys have been here since the beginning of Curious Realm. They have supported us. They have supported our live streams from on-site locations such as MUFON, symposium this last year, Texas Bigfoot Conference, all kinds of things. So thank you so much to them and everything that they do. WebWorksWireless.com is the website, folks. Our guest today, I am very, very excited to have on Kathleen Ball. Kathleen Ball is the spearhead behind the film The Brazilian Templar Mystery. We will be talking about the Knights Templar and their presence in Brazil, what brought them to Brazil, what about the amazing cave that is there. Here in just a second, we will be talking with Kathleen. I want to first, though, play you this trailer, which the entire series is available.
The Templars in Brazil. This is the story of Dr. Kathleen Ball, researcher, traveler, and explorer of ancient sites, and her discovery of a cave. A cave hidden in a remote area on the outskirts of a small Brazilian town.
With the blessing of King Dennis, I believe that they left Portugal to Brazil and colonized the area of the Paraíso, which is where I found the cave.
A cave that was carved by the Knights Templar.
I would say quite clearly that they would have gone as far as Brazil at that time, would have been the extent of the New World, to carve out a new place where they could literally recreate what they had already established.
We will explore how this adventure began and the little-known history of the Templars' travels to Brazil.
Welcome to the show, Kathleen Ball. How are you today?
I'm wonderful. Thank you, Chris. How are you?
I am doing fantastic. I have been very excited about this episode record since our mutual acquaintance, Gretchen Cornwall connected us.
She's a good friend.
I have loved her work. I have loved her books and her new research. Her new book is absolutely amazing. We'll get into your book later, which is upcoming, but let's start off, Kathleen, with what brought you into the world of, I guess, investigating the mysterious, ancient sites, things like that to begin with, which is, of course, the road that led you to investigating Templars in Brazil.
Well, it began, I think my interest in ancient sites and the esoteric in general started when I was young. My father was a professor, and he always taught me how to research and question things, not take things at face value, read a book and take what you need, leave the rest, you know, sort of attitude. And so as I got older, you know, I became a teacher myself. I was an art professor, and on my summer breaks and winter breaks, I would take off and, you know, go to Egypt and go all over the world. Anyway, I went to France a number of times, and on one particular trip, I was invited to go to the Templar, where they kept the Templars in Dome, the jail, you know, underneath the castle. Well, the castle's gone now, mm-hmm. But anyway, I was given the key and said, you know, go in and you can just take as long as you'd like and bring me back the key. So I brought the key back to the little museum that's there, and I just took a ton of pictures. And the next thing I know, I'm on this, you know, I'm ending up at these synchronistic places in Marseille, and went up to St. Baume and had a mystical experience there. I was directed there by a nun in Marseille, who claimed that she had been waiting for me, you know, for years. But anyway, how she knew I was going to be there, I have no idea, but she recognized me. I have no idea. I didn't recognize her. But anyway, so that started it off. And this was this particular trip was in 2009. My first trip was in 2006, when the Da Vinci Code came out as a film. And there was a tremendous amount of controversy while I was in Italy because, you know, Rome wasn't happy about that. In fact, they sued him over that. So, you know, that opened up the Templars and opened up, you know, a whole lot of stuff that had been kept under wraps for centuries. To even though it wasn't, you know, it wasn't completely factual, obviously, but it did bring the Templars into everybody's living room. Yeah. It brought the esoteric into everybody's living room. So, you know, that spurred my interest even more. And I just researched everything I could get on the Templars. I have a number of friends who are Masons, and so I got some information from them, history of Templars in Scotland, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, so fast forward to 2015, I have all this knowledge. I've, you know, been to all these places, blah, 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 blah. What good is it, right? You know? And I was invited to go to Brazil by a girlfriend, Adele Good. And she was actually working for this guy named John of God at that time. She was, you know, taking people for healings and whatnot. And I had a liver disease. I had a very serious liver disease. Wow. And I had liver cancer for 4 years at this point. And so she invited me to come to see John of God. And I said, okay, what the heck? Let's give it a try. You know, who knows?
Yeah.
So we went up there and he wasn't there. He was taking a little hiatus or whatever. So she said, well, let's take off and go up to the Chapada up in central Brazil. And there's some amazing waterfalls up there. So we did. We headed up there. And on the third day, we went down to this one waterfall site, and the fellow that owned the property, that was leasing the property, he said, hey, girls, you want to see this this quartz crystal vein that goes through this property next door to us? And it's about a meter high by about a meter in width. And it runs about 2 to 3 kilometers through the property. And I thought, great. And he said, you know, there's all sorts of crystals that you can pick up and you can take home and stuff. And so we thought that was fantastic. So we went over there, and the guide that met us took us over to this crystal vein, which was magnificent. There was crystals all of them. It's thousands of them. Thousands, probably millions of them.
Cool.
All over the ground. We're picking some up, you know, and we saved a few. Anyway, it was extremely hot. So he said, well, you know, I know this little cave. It's just about another kilometer to half, 2 kilometers down the hill. You want to go and just, you know, we'll have some water and refresh ourselves. So we get to this cave and he lifts up the bushes and my mouth dropped to my knees. I couldn't believe it. I looked up and I said, oh my God. That's a Templar cave. That's a Knight's Templar cross. And he said, you know, in his broken Portuguese, he started rattling off a bunch of stuff, which I had recorded in an interview and had it later translated. But anyway, so we couldn't get into the cave itself. We only got to go into the mouth of the cave at the time because it was filled with bats and probably, I don't know, 20,000 spiders. It was just filled. So I vowed to come back and, you know, and do some more research. So fast forward 2015, I had a liver transplant. I was nine days after I got back from Brazil, my house burned to the ground, blah, blah, blah. It was one heck of a year. So I gave myself a year to recover, 2016. 2017, I went back to Brazil and they had a fire. They had a fire that burned probably... oh, I don't know, probably a good 75,000 acres in the exact area where the cave was. So I wasn't able to get in. And so, but I did meet a fellow who is, he's actually did some film work for Jacques Cousteau, and he offered to come in and film for me the following year. So I went back in 2018. The terrain had completely changed. Everything was different because of the fire. And it took me 3 days to find it, but I did. I found it, and we filmed it, and I was able to get a little bit more back into the depths of the cave, at least. We were able to see, and I was able to see that there was a little graffiti on the walls, and I wasn't able to see clearly. You know, you can see in that, you know, there's also more contemporary stuff, you know, but anyway, so I was able to see this a little bit of graffiti. And so I was even more, intrigued. So now what am I going to do with this footage? You know, that was the next question. So I decided to produce a film. I wanted to document this. From what I understood, there was nothing. There was no research available that the Templars had been in Brazil, in South America, there was absolutely, I couldn't find anything. And I did it. I did a lot of research to try to find out. So I thought, okay, this is important. This is going to change history. So I really felt that it was my responsibility to bring it forward. So I did. I got back. I hooked up with a fellow named Next NXT, and he was a film producer. And Neil Cabana, they did fabulous work, fabulous job on this documentary. I was really pleased with their work. Anyway, so we put this together. Contacted some people to interview in Portugal. I went to Portugal to meet with them at the Convento Cristo, which is the Templar castle and was the basic stronghold for the Templars from the 1100s all the way up to the 15th, 16th century when they became the Knights of Christ. And then they were finally dismantled by the Inquisition in the 1500s. But I got a tremendous amount of history. I was invited back the following year, and I happened to show up the day before the Templars were reorganizing for the first time in 700 years. They had signed a pact or signed an agreement, basically understanding that they were all united once again all across Europe. And I guess it also included South American Templars and North American Templars. Now, just to clarify, not all Templar groups are affiliated with this particular group. There are Templar separate groups in Scotland. There's also separate Templar groups in America, and they're all popping up all over the place. But this particular Templar group claims to go back to the original Templars. They have members whose families date back to the 1300s. So anyway, just to clarify that. And so they invited me to participate in the procession that was sort of commemorating this reunification. And this was in October 2019, and it was absolutely just magnificent. I literally had tears at being in the middle of this procession with all of these people reuniting after 700 years. It just was such a powerful event. And what was even better for me was that I got to meet with some women Templars. Now, this organization has opened its doors to women. And I talked with a woman from Austria, as a matter of fact, while we were walking down this procession. And they are now welcoming women into this organization, which I think is wonderful. And I also found out from that conversation that there had actually been two convents of women, one in Spain and one in Austria, that were all women. And they were women who fought, and they were actually soldiers and fought alongside their male counterparts. So that was really interesting. That was really interesting. I learned a lot during that particular experience and made some really lifelong friends, really good friends in Tomar, Portugal. So, you know, this thing has just kind of taken a life of its own. And this last year, 2021 in October, I went back into Brazil to film the second episode. What I had tended to do was get inside the cave, and I had this plan. I was going to light a little fire in the front of the cave so it'd be safe to smoke out the bats and the spiders. And we were going to sleep above the cave. So, you know, by the time all the bats and spiders left early in the morning, we could go in and film. Well, we got there, and it was in the evening. We got there, and miraculously, all of the spiders were gone, and there was only a handful of bats way in the back of the cave, maybe six or seven bats, and that was it. So it was like, okay, this is great. So I got to go in, and I actually got to get some really good footage of the Templar graffiti that was in there that was almost identical to what I had seen in Dome. And what I also hear is available in Chinon and also in Peniche on the coast in Portugal, which has now drawn me to Peniche, my next research trip will be going back to Portugal, and I will be going into Peniche. I now believe that the Templars left from Peniche to go into Bahia on the coast of Brazil, and then they were led in or guided by the Amazonian tribal natives into central Brazil. And one of the reasons that I believe this is I was given this this idea, actually, from a Templar that I met in Portugal. It's part of his research. But also when I was in Alto Paraíso, which is the area where I found the cave, every year there's five Amazonian tribes that come in and do celebrations out just outside of Alto Paraíso. And they've been doing it for hundreds of years, possibly thousands of years. So if they make that trek every year from the Amazon into Alto Paraíso, it just stands to reason that, you know, it's a very good chance that they brought the Templars or guided the Templars in from the coast of Bahia. So what I did in 2021 was I had it scheduled to interview the chief of one of these tribes that was going to be coming into Alto Paraíso. And because of COVID, they didn't come in. However, they did invite me out to their tribe, into their village, the Penuia village in outside of Rio Branco. It's about a day and a half's journey outside of Rio Branco, right in the interior of the Amazon jungle. And the people are the Huniquim people. And I got to go in and live with them for a period of time. It was wonderful. It was absolutely one of the most life-changing experiences that I think I've ever had. And, you know, in my book, I write extensively about this in the last chapter because, you know, oftentimes people set off on what they call a grail quest. You know, it's been dubbed a grail quest. They go out into the world to try to find something, right? In my case, it's been Templar cave treasure. Who knows what, you know, what I'm going to find, what I'm going to discover.
Sure.
But what ended up happening was when I went to this village, in the Penuia village with the Huniquim people, I was invited to a healing ceremony, and I had been on anti-rejection medications for 6 years at this point. I was able to stop. I was able to stop taking these medications, and I haven't taken them since.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. That is incredible.
Yeah, it's huge. It's huge. I had no anticipation of this. I had not even entered my mind that this was going to be, this was going to happen. I went there specifically to interview the chief, and that was it. But it ended up being a 10-day process. We were invited to live there, eat with them, do their ceremonies with them, everything.
What an incredible experience.
When they opened this up, the chief said to me, there's something you've been wanting to heal. And I said, yeah, as a matter of fact. It's like we had this telepathic relationship. It was just bizarre. But anyway, and throughout the experience, it was. I think the most powerful experience other than my near death that I had in 1990, and in terms of transformational experience, I can't even explain the whole thing. Mm. But when I came out of that experience, I knew that I was never going to have to take them again. And I haven't had to take them ever since. So in fact, I haven't had to take any medication since.
Wow. That is phenomenal.
Yeah. And
while you were with them, what did they say? Did they have anything to say about the Templars in the area, things like that? I mean, once again, this is, it really seems like locally, even the gentleman who brought you to the cave the first time, like you said, started rattling off unendingly about the Templars.
Well, he started rattling off. Actually, what he started rattling off about was that the cave had been used for hundreds of years by women that belonged to the spiritual group of some sort. And that's basically what he was telling me. Okay. He didn't really know that it was a Templar cave.
Gotcha.
He didn't understand the significance of the cross. But what I later did is I went to meet some of these women. And they're involved, they belong to a group called, they're called the Kalunga. And what the Kalunga are, the runaway slaves from that were brought over during the 1500s that escaped. They escaped and they formed these little villages outside. And Alto Paraiso at that time was nobody could get into it. It was so heavily forested that no one could get out there. So this is where they settled, was all around this area in the Chapada. So I went in to interview them, and I found out that, yes, indeed, they did use these caves for shelter. And then later, especially their women, would go in and pray and meditate in these caves. And there's apparently more than one. I have only found this one so far, but I have a possible location on two more that I'll be going back for next year. But what I did find out that was significant is the caves were already there when they came in the 1500s.
Mm.
So, and they had been there for a long time, according to them.
Well, and you know, that is something to consider, because typically when Templars used caves, they were for sacred reasons to begin with, be it an initiation ceremony, what have you.
Right.
And they definitely had a full-on respect for local cultures. Even in my conversations with Gretchen Cornwall, like I've said, not to discount any amount of booty that the Knights Templar had amongst them. You know, they all came from wealthy families, all kinds of things. They made percentages. I mean, they were basically the first banking system as we know. So that amasses something as it happens. That A, makes them a threat to the church. B, the fact that they actively respected local religious custom, and not only that, but actually drew from it the esoteric knowledge.
Yes.
And that is what I believe made them more dangerous than anything, was the fact of the esoteric knowledge, the knowledge of direct connection to the divine.
Exactly. And the practice, the literal practice. Now, keep in mind that this wasn't all of the Templars that were involved in this esoteric.
No, absolutely not.
You know, the masses, the basic, you know, the soldiers and a lot of the other people, you know, that were involved, the members of the Knights Templar, were not privy to this information. This was a core of Templars that I believe. And they were the same core that started the Templar organization. And I believe that it actually, you know, and Freddie and I have talked about this a few times, because it appears to me from my research that the Templars actually began to organize in the 11th century, in the late, you know, 1098. I believe that it actually goes back even further than that. And I believe that they had a plan to basically turn Portugal into a country, a sovereign nation that was under their control. And, you know, keep in mind that Portugal would probably not even exist today had it not been for the Templars conquering the land. And when they did it, they did an interesting thing, though. When they conquered the land, they invited the people to stay.
Yeah.
So when they conquered the Moors, they gave them land and invited them to stay.
Yeah.
When they conquered Islam, they invited them to stay. They also opened the doors to the Cathars when they were being persecuted by the church, the Jews.
Yep.
They were being persecuted.
That was a big one, especially in France. That was directly before. I mean, the King of France was hugely in debt.
Yes.
He was hugely in debt to the Knights Templar and literally tried squeezing the Jewish people for their money.
Right.
And the Templars were like, we are not going to do that for you, you monster. What are you talking about?
Right. And so they, you know, the Portuguese Templars opened their arms to these people and, you know, gave them place. They gave them land. When I was in Portugal, they had just completed excavating a Jewish temple that was on a side street underneath a little shop. As a matter of fact, it had been discovered. And I have the footage from that, had been buried in the, you know, the 15th century. The Inquisition came in, and they literally lived at the temple. I mean, at the convent of Cristo in Tomar. They pushed out all of the Templars, the Knights of Christ at that point, persecuted them. Anybody who still persisted, they killed them. They killed their family members, blah, blah, blah. And they did the same thing with the Jews. So anything that the Jews had at that point in Portugal was buried or burned or destroyed some way. Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting, too, because the Lost Relics guys, Hamilton White and Carl Cookson, their discovery of those relics that they had recently, there was a show about that they had. Those are said to have been buried in the 15th century during the time of the Inquisition. So there's a lot pointing to the fact that just, you know, everything was at that point buried, hidden, or whatever because of the Inquisition.
That brings us to a big question. Why Brazil?
Well, I don't think it was just Brazil. In fact, what my series is about is I'm going to be going to Ethiopia, back to India. I'm going to be going into Austria. I'm going to be going into Spain. I'm going to be going into a lot of other countries. The Templars did not just go. They did not just stay in Europe. They went into South America. They were in North America. They were all over the globe. The only country so far that I haven't researched, have been able to find anything on the Templars is Japan and Australia at this point, and China.
Wow.
So I have found Templar crosses all over the world. In, you know, my boot, I do what I call boots on the ground research. I go to countries. I just get out into the rural areas. If they're, you know, locals tell me about a cave, I'm on it. That's how I work. So, you know, I have seen Templar crosses in numerous places. And my personal belief is, you know, there was a great deal of speculation that one of the things the Templars were protecting was the bloodline of Jesus Christ and Mary Magdalene.
Sure.
This is what I was told in 2009 by the curator of the museum in Dome, France. He said directly to me, he said, "Do you know what the Templars were protecting?" And I said, "Well, I have a pretty good idea, but I'd like to hear your take." And he said, "The bloodline of Jesus and Mary Magdalene was very, very important to them." And I said, "Okay." So, you know, there was that corroboration. So after finding evidence of the Templars in many locations as I have, I believe today that there are probably millions of descendants. And I think that was helped along by the Templars, who many of them themselves were descendants, dispersed all over the world to spread the bloodline.
Interesting. And once again, even the thought of that, especially with the Catholic Church, former Catholic seminarian, that's a big hot tater.
Well, it would be, but it's just a theory, you know.
And that is a lot of the reason why the church got involved when Dan Brown's book came out and when the movie came out, things like that. And sure, 90% of that was the easiest way to put it is hyperbole based on hyperbole. When it came to the documents that the book traced. But what the church had to address was that bloodline question. And that's what they really got upset about.
Well, whenever I see a reaction like that, it tells me that you've hit a nerve.
Well, and for me, it's odd knowing, especially the connection of the church, its ceremony, everything else to Judaism. And the fact that Jesus himself was a pretty law-abiding Jew, it would have been hard to imagine at 33 that he was not betrothed.
Well, it would have been, I mean, in my
it
mind,
it would have been almost unheard of.
He wouldn't have been considered a rabbi, certainly.
Absolutely.
No one would have followed him. Secondly, yep. No one would have listened to a word he said.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So
it just stands to reason that he most likely was married, and if that's the case, he most likely had children.
Yeah, even if socially married, what have you. There may not have been a huge mitzvah about it. Who knows? But the fact of him not being married, especially with the connection of Mary Magdalene there in every gospel, gospel in the same way. That's pretty hard. It's a pretty hard stretch not to imagine, because once again, he definitely was in the rabbi position lot of people.
Yes, he was. He was respected. You know, he was allowed into the temple to teach. You know, he was respected as a rabbi. And he certainly came from that background in his family. So,
well, and a lot of what I've said, even about Christ, is that a big reason why he would be listened to at 12 years old by rabbis of the temple would be because he was a Kabbalistic student.
More than likely. I agree with that. We have absolutely no evidence of it, of course. But
no.
But I do agree that he was definitely privy to the esoteric.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, full line of Melchizedek, the direct communion with God beyond the temple, beyond burnt sacrifice.
You want to hear something even more interesting? Please. In my research, I have found, this is also in my book, but I have found a order of knights that was created by Zerubbabel in 600 and something BC when the second temple was being rebuilt.
Interesting.
Fascinating. I found this in the Rosicrucian Library, where I do a lot of my research there, because after my house burned down, I had over 5,000 books in my library. I lost them all. They burnt with the house. So I often go over to the Rosicrucian Library to do my research. I found that. And then so what my challenge has been, and one of the reasons I'm going to Peniche, is to see if I can discover any of the family names and find out if the family names, any of the family names were the same as any of the Templars from the original Templars organization.
Interesting.
Yeah,
that is a far back connection there.
Well, it is. And if I can, you know, then it would show a family line coming forward. You see what I mean?
Absolutely. And
I think that you know, most people that may have been involved or privy to this information had a vested interest in keeping this secret, because obvious reasons, because of the church at the time, the power of the church at the time.
Sure.
But, you know, it just everything I keep finding out keeps leading to, well, why were they so invested in destroying the Templars? Why were they so invested in stopping this film by Dan Brown? You know, why are they still to this day? So I did some more research in the Rosicrucian Library, and I found several books on, and one actually, every single chapter was on a country where the Jesuits were sent to South America to kill the families and descendants of any Templars that were there.
Wow.
And I have pages and pages and pages and pages of this research that shows that there was a strategic plan to go into South America, into Brazil, into Peru, into these separate countries, and search out the descendants of any Templars and their families and kill them.
Man, that is absolutely incredible to even think about, because once again, that would show an active campaign of obliteration beyond what we already know occurred.
Right. So, and this of is course available. You know, this book is available. It's a Masonic book. And it's available in the Rosicrucian Library. It's also, I found it. I was talking with this with another researcher friend of mine in Scotland, and he was able to find the book in a library there somewhere. So
Well, and the Rosicrucians are, I mean, that's an episode in and of itself. I'm getting ready to contact somebody about that. Because I've been fascinated by them for years. They, of course, are one of the big groups talking about the mysticism of Christ, as well as the connection of the bloodline, the Merovingian bloodline amongst Europe, things like that.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, when I was speaking with researchers in Portugal about this, because there's a little chapel that's dedicated to Mary Magdalene in Tomar, and they also agreed that was very possible, very possibly their agenda, and possibly their primary agenda, was to populate the world with these descendants of this bloodline. So that's my current line of research, and it's taken me all over the world. and it's just fascinating. The more I learn, the more I want to know. And, you know, and I think that the timing is interesting, because here we are, the 700 year anniversary in 2019 of the Templars, and their reorganization all over the world. You know, I mean, we see Templar organizations popping up everywhere.
Yeah.
And so they really have gained public awareness, public support, public interest, definitely public interest in this, especially in this time in history. And so I think it's exciting. I really believe that we're living in exciting times. You know, with this reorganization of the Templars.
Well, and, you know, it's interesting. One of the things that we talk about regularly on this show is the seeming religion of science and history. Mm-hmm. And even now, despite things like this being out there, despite pieces of work like your film, who you worked with Freddie Silva, like there's... It's like people still deny the fact that the Templars ever made it to the New World, that they ever left anywhere beyond the shores of Europe or the Middle East.
Right. You know, but I don't understand how people can even come to that conclusion.
Yeah.
But here they were in the Middle East. They had the Phoenician maps. They had access to the Phoenician scrolls and whatnot. The Phoenicians were the boat builders, for God's sake. And so as soon as the Templars come back into Europe, into Portugal primarily, who were the boat builders for all of Europe?
Yeah.
The Portuguese. You know, they were the leaders in the whole naval, you know, beginning of the naval organization as a military force across Europe. They were the ones that they were the boat builders. So why not?
Yeah.
I mean, what are you going to do with a boat, right? You're going to explore. You're going to go to foreign lands. You're going to dig up maps. And if my research is, my theory is true, then they already had these maps. They already knew where they were going.
Yeah, precisely. Precisely. You know, and
when they went to Brazil, when they went to South America, they called Brazil Las Cruces, which meant the cross. Yeah. They told everybody back in Europe that it was an island, because they didn't want everybody else coming over and trying to colonize it. And another thing that, you know, about my cave, which is fascinating, is the fact that it's a gold mine.
Really?
Yes, it's a gold mine. There's nothing in it. I've metal detect the whole thing. There's no gold left. But I did find out from the locals that they were pulling gold out of here as late as 1930s.
Oh.
So if this was a gold mine, and there is actually two more caves, which I've been told there are, and possibly even more, they probably were taking this gold back and forth to Portugal, having everybody believing that it was an island they discovered, by the boatloads.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, even whenever you look at the Templar presence in North America.
Yeah.
Which Freddie Silva has a great book about. And there's been tons of research. It's really interesting to see all of the artifacts that are kind of coinciding with Knights Templar and especially Portugal.
Yes,
coming out of Oak Island.
Portugal is really being focused on. I've noticed the Oak Island programs, yeah. The Oak Island and Beyond now, they're really focusing on these artifacts from Portugal.
Oh, yeah.
And fascinating. You know, it's fascinating to me because I think Portugal's key to opening up a whole lot of this research and bringing it forward to the public. And it's our connection. I think Portugal is the connection that we've all been searching for, you know, to connect the Templars to their travel, because I do believe that they left from Peniche. I think they had a private port there. This is what I'm going to be going to investigate. I believe they had a private port there, and this is where they left to go to India, to go to South America, possibly North America, wherever else that they left, you know, to go to. I think that this is where they left. And interesting enough, in Peniche, this was done with the king's blessing.
Oh, wow.
So if this was done with the king's blessing, the king, it stands to reason, would have wanted something in return. And what better than gold from Brazil?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, coincidentally, at that time in history, Portugal was one of the richest countries in the world in silver and gold.
And when you're talking about especially Knights Templar moving to Portugal, the them scurrying away in the middle of the night, it not only were they a military order, but they had spies in all camps.
Absolutely.
Not just military spies, but familial spies. Like,
absolutely.
You know, familial ties in just about every royal court across Europe.
Absolutely.
So seeing anything like that coming would have been pretty, I don't think they found out when the horse steps were coming down the road. Let's just say that.
Yeah, exactly. With anything, I mean, I know most people I know, when there's something bad that's about to happen, you kind of get a sixth sense, you know, about that.
Yeah.
And I think that the writing was on the wall. The propaganda was certainly being circulated about the Templars by the King of France at the time. You know, he was painting a picture of them being these terrible people. He was trying to dismantle the support, the public support.
Yeah.
For the people against the Templars. He had a strategic campaign before he arrested them.
Yeah.
So you'd have to be an idiot not to pay attention to those signposts, you know.
Well, and once again, that was all seriously due to the debt that he was in with the Templars.
Absolutely.
And when they refused to help squeeze the Jewish people to get their money.
Absolutely. And his father had left him in a great deal of debt as a result of the Crusades. Mm. So when he inherited the throne, he was broke. The coffers were next to empty, basically. So he had to come up, in his mind, he had to come up with a way to replenish those coffers. And the first thing that's been done over and over in history, we've seen this repeated. The first thing he did was go after what the Jews owned. And take their property, their land, their money, everything you could get from them.
Strip titles, everything.
You know, that wasn't enough for him. And so, you know, there was also some speculation that he himself had wanted to become a Templar and was denied for whatever reason. So there was some animosity there, possibly. And they certainly were a gold mine in his eyes. You know, they certainly were a means for him to improve his financial situation at that point and to wipe out the debt all in one, you know, two birds with one stone.
Yeah.
So, you know, he had a lot of motivation to get rid of the Templars. Let's put it that way.
Just a little bit. Now, with that being said, and with your research at hand, you've been mentioning a new book. Let's talk about that for a minute and what the next steps in your research are.
Okay. Well, I wrote during COVID. I wasn't obviously able to travel, along with everybody else. So I decided, okay, well, I'm going to go ahead and get my, I'll go ahead and start, write my book. So my book is, I've written it from a memoir perspective. It goes into my background as a researcher child, you know, a little background family, my spiritual awakening that happened in 1990 as a result of a near-death experience, and then fast forward into my research as a Templar historian and ancient sites researcher. And I, you know, I go into the discovery of the cave, obviously, and then I also talk about going into the Amazon jungle and what happened in the Amazon jungle. So the book itself, it's called A Grail Quest, and I call it that specifically because I feel that's what I've been on, basically, is a grail quest. I have made tremendous personal discoveries and had spiritual awakening. All sorts of things have happened, and ultimately, you know, the last thing that I experienced in my travels was a physical healing. So I think that qualifies as a grail quest. You know, and then, of course, a lot of, I emphasize the discovery of the cave in Brazil, because I think that that historically is very important to bring to the masses and for people to be able to read about it and understand, you know, that the Templars were all over the world. So my next book that I'm working on now is I'm talking about the Templars all over the world, you know, and all the different places that they were all over the world. And I'll also be talking about my theory that I believe that the Templars were wanting to populate the world with the bloodline of Jesus Christ and Mary Magdalene.
To what end for that? I don't want you to spoil your book, but to what end?
Well, I'm not going to talk about that.
Okay.
I talk about that in my book. I want to leave a little something for imagination and, you know, but, yeah, but I do have some ideas on that. So,
well, I want to thank you for your time. I cannot wait to watch the rest of the Brazilian Templar mystery. That is available on Gaia Network, folks. And I know how some of our listeners and even a few of our guests feel about Gaia.
It's also on Amazon Prime.
Oh, is it? Fantastic. Fantastic. Yeah. Because, you know, I have Gaia. I'm a member of Gaia, and I am because there's works like yours on there. There's works like Freddie Silva's, who I highly, highly respect. Anything he puts out, I immediately watch. And a lot of times those are some of the only places to find them full and uncut. I support networks like that because they are pursuing content like yours and trying to bring it to a larger audience. And I am fully behind that effort. I think it's fantastic. Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to watch the Brazilian Templars mystery, as well as your website, and how they can contact you with information, anything like that, Kathleen.
They can go to the website, which is www.templarsinbrazil.com. You can also, I do put quite a bit of photos and whatnot and research information on my Facebook page, which is Kathleen Ann, A-N-N-E, Ball, B-A-L-L, my Facebook page. And then I also have a Templar Facebook page as well, Templars in Brazil. And the website does have probably the most information. You can also watch the trailer there. But if you want to watch the full feature film, you can go on Gaia, or you can stream it on Amazon Prime. So,
all right. Well, fantastic. Thank you so much once again for your time. I have thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. I would love to have you on again and again. Knights Templar and their quest across the world is one of the most fascinating topics out there for me. It's so riveting and such an amazing, literal just nook and cranny of history that infiltrates and tendrils into so many other things. It's fascinating. So thank you so much for your time and for your dogged efforts in research of these topics.
You're very welcome, Chris. It was a pleasure.
Absolutely. Please do hold the line while we close things out. While you are online checking out everything from Dr. Kathleen Ball and TemplarsInBrazil.com, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm, folks. That is where you can find all the episodes. That's where you can find our knowledge vault full of declassified government materials, documents, esoteric materials, all kinds of things. That's also where you can find our Share Your Story page, curiousrealm.com/story. If you are an experiencer of the paranormal, the strange, if you have had a cryptid sighting, if you have information about Knights Templar ruins in your area in America, anything like that, stop on by and check that out. curiousrealm.com/story. Thank you so much, as always, for tuning in, everybody. Take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and remember, stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Download the official Curious Realm app and view the knowledge vault on our website, curiousrealm.com. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast services, as well as YouTube, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Apple TV through the APR TV app, available on all app markets. Curious Realm is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more great content or to become a sponsor of Curious Realm or other podcasts, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.